There's a task in life that I'm three quarters of the way through, and that is helping my children learn how to drive. I have three out of four accomplished. My youngest is still a few years off. But, you know, there is a certain terror and joy to helping our young ones learn what is otherwise an essential skill to living in the 21st century here in the United States. I say terror because cars are dangerous. There is absolutely nothing safe about teaching a young person how to pilot a couple of tons worth of fuel-propelled danger. And but there's also joy to it because you get to see them mature. And you get to see them take on responsibility, because it is a tremendous responsibility to drive an automobile. You get to see them learning how to do adult things. In many ways, it is that threshold to adulthood that comes at about 15 and a half, that you're just starting to dip your toes into what it means to live in the world of us grown-ups. And so I do enjoy having the opportunity to sit with my kids in a car while we try to do that maneuverability thing 6 billion times in a row, which if you've never had a chance to do that, you get halfway through and think, if we could only just parallel park, that would make life so much easier. I think I could teach that so much faster. But it is important because when you sit down with your kids in the car the first time, as a lifelong driver, you forget all of the things that you just instinctively know, you know, and you find yourself saying to your kids things like, before you put it in gear, you have to turn it on. It never occurred to you to say, put the key in the ignition, turn the key to its fullest, or nowadays, leave the keys in your pockets, put your foot on the brake pedal and push the button. Because of course that's how they work now. But you have to break things down into simple, understandable steps that are oftentimes interlocking. That if you don't do step A, adjust your rearview mirror and or make sure you can see your rearview camera, then you can't do step B, which is put the car in reverse, and you certainly can't do step C, which is step on the gas and go backwards. You have to do those things in order. If you do them out of order, horrible things start happening. You start backing into telephone poles, which has happened not to any of my kids, but I've known a lot of people that it's happened to, that they thought that car was in drive and they just stepped right on the gas and went right backwards into, say, a garage door. It happens, that's life. You gotta do things in a certain order. So when Jesus is speaking to this teacher of the law, he says to the teacher of the law, what is it that God requires of us? And the teacher of the law says, you are to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and you are to love your neighbor as yourself. Now, it's important to note that this is God teaching humanity how to drive life. And this is not two independent sets of instructions. These are two interlocking sets of instructions. If you don't do the first right, you can't do the second. Trying to love your neighbor without first loving God is like trying to back up without looking in your rearview mirror. Chances are you're going to do it wrong. Because our source for wisdom, understanding, compassion, our very wellspring of the love that we have to give to our neighbor comes first and foremost from God. If we don't have that relationship with God that we are being nourished by, uplifted by, and educated and illuminated by, we can't possibly hope to effectively love our neighbor, because that is the source through which we get to be in a state where we can effectively love our neighbor. You can't reverse the car until you've checked your rearview mirror and hopefully put it in reverse. Otherwise, you're going to drive in the opposite direction. Jesus is trying to express this to the teacher of the law, so he tells them a story. After all, isn't that what Jesus does so often, as he tells these great stories? And like I said to the little kids who are up here, in Jesus's day, there were things about the story that people would have just automatically understood. First and foremost being that the Samaritans and the Jews were enemies. They weren't enemies because of what they believed. The Jews and the Samaritans believed the same thing almost entirely. They had the same God. They had the same laws. They had the same history. They had the same ancestry. They just disagreed about real estate. You see, the Israelites believed that God had said that the mountain that the city of Jerusalem is built on is the place where you are to offer your offerings and your sacrifices. And the Samaritans said, no, it's our mountain in Samaria that God has said that we're supposed to offer our offerings on. And so the Samaritans and the Israelites, absolutely identical to each other, except they both are convinced that their piece of property is the right piece of property. Interestingly enough, the Samaritans still exist. You can still go to Israel and they're still offering sacrifices and offerings on top of their own mountain that's not the city of Jerusalem. But for this simple reason, the Samaritans and the Jews did not like each other a little bit. So Jesus begins this story and he throws this Samaritan in. But first, he puts some more recognizable characters in. A man is getting up and he's going and he gives this travel itinerary that makes it very clear to the listener that the traveler is Jewish. He's going from a Jewish place to a Jewish place. So he is clearly, probably, a Jewish character. And he falls in among robbers. They strip him, they beat him, they leave him for dead along the side of the road. And then we have a Levite and a priest. And these Levite and this priest, they walk by him on the other side of the road. And if you read that story without being a first century Jew, you don't know why they did it that way. You just assume that Jesus is describing two cold, cruel, unpleasant individuals who have done the wrong thing, but that's not what Jesus is describing. What we know about the individual laying on the ground by the road is that he has been beaten and left for dead. So for all intents and purposes, he appears to be a dead body. What is it that a Levite and a priest can't do by law? They can't touch a dead body. If they touch a dead body, it will make them ritually unclean. And if they become ritually unclean, then they cannot satisfy the duties of their jobs. They cannot do priestly or Levitical work until they've gone through a long, arduous, expensive, and annoying cleansing process. So they see a dead body along the side of the road and they give it wide berth, because touching the dead body would cause them to have to go through a lot of hassle. Now, maybe the guy's alive, maybe he's not, but they're not willing to take the risk. They're not willing to stop and check for a pulse, if you will. Because if they check for that pulse and the guy's dead, then they're going to be off work for a couple of weeks. It's going to be a whole hassle. It's going to cost them money. It's just going to be a thing, and they don't have to do that. And so what do? They walk by on the far side of the road. Well, that's the religious reason why they might have done that. What's the other reason they might have done that? Well, very simply put, this is a very common ruse from Jesus' day. If you wanted to rob somebody, and by the way, this still happens, a way to do it is to present a distraction. An accomplice who lays down beside the road and appears to be injured, so that the traveler will stop and be vulnerable. And while they have stopped and being vulnerable, your accomplice who is laying on the side of the road, appearing as though they are dead, can jump up with a knife or a sword or a club or whatever weapon they might have on hand, while you are then surrounded from behind with other robbers and you yourself become the victim. So it's not safe. It's neither physically safe nor is it religiously safe for the Levite or for the priest to stop and administer to the man who has been left dead next to the side of the road. So it's not as though they don't have good reasons to do it. By do it, I mean walk by. They have good reasons. When I was in seminary, I loved, and you may have noticed this about me, the act of preaching. I've always enjoyed preaching. And so I signed up for all the preaching classes I could get my hands on. And one of the preaching classes was preaching on the parables of Jesus. And this was my maybe second year in seminary, I think. And I remember I drew the parable of the Good Samaritan as my assignment for my first sermon in preaching on the parables of Jesus. And part of the process of learning to preach in seminary is you would give your sermon in front of your classmates, and then your classmates would have basically a scorecard in front of them, you know, and they're 9.5. So that wasn't quite that bad. But they would have a rubric in front of them, and they would have notes that they would make. And then once you were done preaching, you just have to stand there while everyone critiqued your sermon and said, well, I like this, or I didn't like that, or why'd you do it this way, or I would have done it that way. And it was a slightly intimidating process, I have to say. And I remember having given this sermon on the Good Samaritan and talking about how the fact is that it's not safe to have stopped and to have looked in on this man, but that it is part of what God is calling us to do. And I remember a young lady that was in the class, and I even remember her name for no particular reason. Her name was Amy Oschlager, which was a really good German sounding name. I felt like that was a perfect Lutheran pastor sounding name. And she said, well, I don't know, the sermon made me feel very uncomfortable. She says, as a woman, if I were out on the road and I saw somebody who was stopped and in some sort of, you know, distress, maybe laying by the, I would feel uncomfortable and unsafe, and I would probably pass by that individual because I would feel uncomfortable and unsafe. I don't know that we need to encourage people to do unsafe things, and I remember thinking, that's kind of exactly what Jesus is encouraging us to do. Jesus is reminding us that God's love for us and the love that we're called to have for other people isn't a safe love. It isn't an earthly safe love. It's a divinely safe love because we are guaranteed to always be in God's hands, but it might put us in danger. It might put us at risk. It might inconvenience us. It might make our lives complicated and difficult, but God has called us to love the world in such a way that we set aside our own personal boundaries and we say to ourselves, how has God loved us first? Remember, we're now back to following the instructions, doing things in proper order. How has God loved us first, and how are we called to love God? We're called to love God with all of our hearts, all of our souls, and all of our minds, and all of our strength. Not the safe bits, not the convenient moments, not when it is easy, but all. And so when then Jesus describes the situation of the Samaritan, here is somebody who not only has a lot to risk with regard to purity, because even though he's a Samaritan, he follows the same rules as the Jews. He knows if he touches a dead body, he himself will be unclean and he'll have to go through the process. He knows that he is in risky territory, that there are bandits around. He might get robbed himself. This might be a ruse. This might be an accomplice ready to jump up and poke him with a sword. He knows that this is also extra danger because he knows it's a Jew who already hates him, who has a prejudice against him, who is looking to do things and to say things and to take actions to inconvenience him for having been a Samaritan. And so he has no guarantee that this individual will have any kind of appreciation for what he's done. And yet he does it anyway. See, this is how God loves us. Even though we do not always love him back, even though we're imperfect, even though we're defiling in the fact that we are sinners and God is perfect, even though it is not safe for God to love us, Jesus died on the cross. Jesus was persecuted. Jesus was treated by the very people who should have understood him best as though he were their enemy. And yet he loved them wholly and completely. There was nothing safe about the way God has chosen to love us. And there should be nothing safe about the way we love God back. This does not mean that God leaves us without hope. God is our hope. God is our strength. God is our comfort. God is our certainty that all that in this life that we do that is risky and dangerous in the life that is to come will never have to be something we face again. No. We are called to love our neighbors. We are called to love with a love that is neither safe nor even practical. We are called to love our neighbors lavishly, generously, unlimited in our willingness to love our God and Father first. We are then enabled to go out into the world and love others wholly and completely. So this is what Jesus is explaining to this teacher of the law as he is teaching this teacher of the law how to drive his faith. He says, first you put your key in the ignition and you love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. And then you go out and you love your neighbor as yourself and you drive that car. My first employer was a man of colorful phrases. And he didn't like the way I drove cars because I tended to drive right at or slightly under the speed limit. And he would hate to get in a car with me anywhere. And he would always look at me and go, "Darn it, Russ, drive it like you stole it." Which I almost never did. But I will say this much. When God is teaching us to drive our lives of faith, he's not calling us to be reckless, but he is calling us to be fearless. He is calling us to be generous. And he is calling us to do the things that require courage, strength, perseverance, and self-sacrifice. Amen.